Sure, you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with the first three verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 4. I looked again at all those being oppressed who were worked under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, and they had no one to comfort them. Again, take that as referring to the oppressed, saying it twice for emphasis. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. And we wrapped up here, or stopped at point 42. The dead are being superior, are viewed as superior, not because they are dead, but simply because they no longer have to observe the injustice, oppression, and the sorrows of this life. 43, Job expresses a similar idea in his initial lament. He perceives the dead to be at rest, free from the taskmaster and those that bring trouble to this life. Job 3:17 through 19. And now, and what we have, that you have to keep in mind here is Job's out of fellowship when he says this. So that's one of the challenges, again, if you're ever going to do this book, is you have to recognize that far and away, much of it's written or spoken by people that are out of fellowship, but it doesn't mean they've lost every ounce of doctrine they ever had or anything. I mean, they come to wrong conclusions, and you can't go through the book of Job and justify everything that's there and said as being divine viewpoint by any stretch of the imagination. And, and Job lets you know pretty much right off the bat there in chapter 3 that he's out of fellowship when he curses the day of his birth. That's pretty much, not somebody that's a happy camper, that's real pleased with God and all that at that time. So Job 3:17 through 19, there the wicked cease from raging. And he's talking about here, as a miscarriage I wouldn't exist, in verse 16, as infants that never saw light. The wicked ceased from raging. And there the weary are at rest. The prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there. And the slave is free from his master. So there, 44, this certainly makes it clear that even Solomon, with all his wealth, fame, power, women, wisdom, etc., was not immune to the emotional pressure that life brings to all people. It doesn't really matter at a certain level who you are. You're not going to avoid certain things. And one of the laments of one of the psalmists was he looked at the evil, the wicked out there, and said, they're always at rest. They got an easy life. Well, here's a heads up. Nobody has an easy life. No matter how well you can feather your nest, no matter how much money you have, no matter how much fame or power you have, there are certain things you can't avoid. And certain tragedies befall everybody, and you can't get around them. Even the wealthy get sick. Can't avoid it. Well, 45, verse 3 carries forward and advances the thought of verse 2. Solomon, or Koheleth, now asserts that it is better never to have lived than to have lived and died. 46, although the thoughts betray a pessimistic and depressed view, they are certainly consistent with one who has come to hate life. 47, ironically, it would seem that Koheleth finds all these things so distasteful, since he has a much higher conception of what life should be. And that gets into why does he never advocate, say, suicide or putting an end to it all or all of this. Even in the midst of all that he sees that's wrong in the world and all the things that he would like to change and all the futility that's out there, he still advocates living your life and having some fun. He doesn't just despair of life and say, well, just forget it. He recognizes, and then he offers, and begins to, as he's working his way through all this, begins to offer some rather practical advice to his younger audience on how you're going to live life. And he'll do this through a series of proverbs. Hey, you need to know this and this, all that. And then he'll basically give them some strict advice. And occasionally, every now and then, he'll sprinkle in an imperative. Do this. If you're going to do it, do this. But he's going to, throughout this book, again, rather than, even though he might find all this oppressive, it would seem that he finds it oppressive because he does have that life should be better than this, he thinks. That this shouldn't be this way. And so throughout the book, he continues to advocate, look, what can you do? And the best thing you can do is relax, enjoy the niche God has provided for you, take some measure of pride in it, eat and drink, and do your job as we might say, he wouldn't say, but we would say, as unto the Lord, and let God bring good things to you if he wants to, in his timing. And so this gets completely away from the standard Babylonian point of view that it permeates our country. It's either unrestrained merrymaking, hedonism, or working your fingers to the bone and put aside every penny and never enjoy anything. So you can get ahead, so you can get to that magical age of retirement when you'll be happy then. And who knows? He advocates sort of a middle view that says, okay, look, why deny yourself everything in life? Is this going to make you happy? No, it doesn't. Now, on the other hand, why cater to yourself everything in life? Will that make you happy? No, it won't. And so the middle ground somewhere seems to be, okay, enjoy the things you can enjoy. And find whatever it is you like to do and do it. And pray about, obviously, we would say pray about it. Pursue this as unto the Lord. And let God bless you and bring you along. And he will. And that's one of the things, but of course, as an older, wiser guy, you kind of figure out. I remember when I first started on doctrine. And we were, because it was a fundy, I was starving to death out there. And I knew I was hungry, but I didn't know where to go to get fed. And so, when I found doctrine, because I was on full maintenance, quote, at the time, what we would call full maintenance, I had plenty of time during the day. And I was listening to 3, 4, 5 Bible classes every day. Hours of doctrine. I was absorbing it like a sponge. I have all these questions I wanted answered, and the longer I'd pursue it, the more these questions got answered. But see, God answers them in his own time. He doesn't give you all the truth all at once. It's just not going to happen that way. So you have to be patient and recognize, God's in control of all this. Now, Solomon would at least acknowledge that at this point, as he has acknowledged God's sovereignty over all these changing fortunes of life. Behind it all, we know that God has a plan. Now, we may not always understand that plan. We may not even always like that plan. But we can comfort ourselves by knowing that, God is for us. And he's even going to allude to that he's going to point out, look, God's already approved you. Now, if God's approved you, then, go ahead and live life. And so, again, as a believer, we would encourage you to pray, think about it. But in your niche, one, I've seen both types of people. I've seen the person that works themselves to death, never has anything, denies themselves every pleasure, and feels righteous and justified about it. And then I've seen the person that just gives them, and if they want it, they get it. Solomon kind of approach to life. And the answer, again, I believe, is somewhere in the middle. If you want something, pray about it, ask God to bless you, and let him provide it for in his time. And when he does it, it will be without pain. It will be without you having to kill yourself to get it. One of the things, of course, in America, and this is why we're going to be facing, and we are already starting in it, is this horrible way before closures that's going to come on the housing market. It's already started, but it's going to get worse. Why? Because people went out and did the typical American stupidity and overextended themselves. Buy as much house as you can get. Well, that's human viewpoint. I would say buy as much house as you need, which is often far less than what you can get. But that because of the nature of the housing market, the plummeting values and all of that, now some people are stuck with houses they can't afford, and they're not worth what they paid for them. I'll buy real estate. It always goes up. No, it doesn't. These things run in cycles. You can probably go chart it out, and there's probably a cycle to it all that you could see that's out there. So, again, the typical Babylonian says, the highest and the best, let's get it all. No. Solomon says, enjoy the smaller pleasures in life. You don't have to eat at a 5-star restaurant every night. A good hot dog can be just as good as anything. If you like hot dogs, I guess. Some of you don't like hot dogs. Well, So you go to the fair and you buy yourself a corn dog, and you enjoy it. Well, that's as good as it gets right there. That's as every, you know, if you're hungry and you like it, that's every bit as good as a, you know, a prime steak. So again, in life, you at a certain level, you take what you can get. And you're going to see things that oppress you, just like Solomon did. Don't let it get you down, would be my advice. But I've always advocated that. Don't let the highs get you too high, and don't let the lows get you too low. Try to maintain somewhat of an even keel. But this is a part of, and it's not only good advice for pastors, that's a part of the pastor's godliness code. You're not supposed to have these, you know, wild emotional mood swings. We all have them from time to time. I recognize nobody's perfect. But you're supposed to be level-headed. The sober command there in 1 Timothy doesn't have to do with alcohol. It has to do with even an even keel and an even level head. So here, again, I think he finds this stuff distasteful because, look, he thinks life should be better. And we see things out there that we don't like. And, yeah, life maybe should be better. But you know what? It's not. We can sit around and bemoan it all day long. But is it going to change anything? No. All it does is bum you out to sit there and think about it. So, and of course, he's intentionally doing this. As he says, I turned to consider this. I want to focus my attention on this. Okay. Well, 48, it is clear that he sees oppression in Israel, a nation that presumably had a firm belief in Elohim. What really troubles him is that he does not see the righteous moral order that is consistent with such a belief. Exodus 22:22. And so what we would like, and again, in an ideal world, everything would be perfect. Okay, we don't live in an ideal world. We're never going to live in an ideal world. Well, we will someday, but not here. Until Jesus Christ, and even in the millennium, it won't be an ideal world. There will be things that go on. There will be acts of oppression and all of that. There will be people that are negative. We see at the end of the millennium, negative volition is going to attempt to surround and overwhelm whatever positive volition is there. And then we'll have an ideal world when we get into the new heavens and the new earth. Then we'll have an ideal world, one in which righteousness dwells. And everything will be great at all times. And there'll be none of this oppression. There'll be none of these bad things going on. It'll all be justice and righteousness and peace and love and all those things that we were going to bring about in the 60s. Well, we didn't quite make it, did we? A little bit of a problem with society. You didn't change it. Exodus here, 22:22. You shall not afflict the widow or the orphan. Well, actually, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him. Verse 21. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict a widow or orphan. Again, they tended to go after the lower classes of society because they were less able to defend themselves. If you afflict him at all and he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry and my anger will be kindled. And I will kill you with the sword and your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. So Deuteronomy also 10:18. This is the kind of order that is envisioned in the Mosaic Law, something of which, of course, Solomon would have been familiar. But he doesn't see this going on in Israel. Just as if you look around and if you really carefully checked out the news and followed the legal system, you would say, well, it's not going on here either. Deuteronomy 10:18. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow. He shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. But does Solomon see this? No, apparently not. And that troubles him at some level. This is not consistent with what God said he would do. And it appears that men get away with murder sometimes and get away with oppression and all of that. Well, again, even though he knows there's a judgment coming, does it comfort him in this? It does not appear to me. So 49, for a nation that had been delivered from a history of oppression and injustice, it is especially inconsistent to resort to that type of activity. Genesis 15:13 gives us the prophecy there that was given to Abraham. Or actually, he was still Abram at that time. And again, the translation here is not great. It's know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. Although they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years, they will serve them. And so, and the idea here is that, of course, as Israel went into Egypt, They provided quite a valuable service to the Egyptians, beginning, of course, with Joseph. Joseph delivered the Egyptians from that famine that was coming, the seven-year famine. And essentially, the royalty of that time ended up owning everything. And the nation, at least certainly at the highest levels, was quite prosperous. And but I will also judge the nation, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And this is a prophecy again, and this actually is divided into the 430 years from the promise to Abraham to the giving of the law, is divided into two 215-year sections. Exactly. Why it worked out this neatly, I don't know, but it did. The chronology works out perfectly. And so this is an allusion from Galatians, the 430 years from the giving of the promise to Abraham to the giving of the law at Sinai. And so essentially what happens is Abraham abides in Canaan for 215 years. Well, he dies. He doesn't abide there all the time, but that's when it started back there, was when he got to Canaan. And then the Jews were actually in Egypt 215 years. And this verse says, it says 400 here. And I don't want to get into all this. I don't want to get too far afield here. But the fact is, the 400 is from the birth of Isaac. That's the trick there. That's why it's 400. It's from the birth of Isaac to the Exodus, to the giving of the law at Sinai. So again, the Jews went into Egypt and helped the Egyptians a lot, Exodus 3:9. And then they served as a source of slave labor, being oppressed by the Egyptians, as per the prophecy. And this all came to pass, again, after the death of Joseph, as you moved into the 13th dynasty of Egypt. Exodus 3:9. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppressions with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. And Exodus 22:21. So God's aware of all this. Of course, they were praying about it, crying out to God. And by the way, I don't remember the specific date, but the Feast of the Trumpets is coming up here pretty shortly. Maybe the rapture will be in September. I think it's the 16th this year. 22:21. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And God cites this to them pretty regularly to remind them that it's very inconsistent as a people. When you've been treated this way, and you know how you didn't like it, for you to turn around and do this to other people. Book of Judges now, 2:18. And Judges gets into the history of a period of Israel's history in which they suffered under various oppressors at various times. And it always was a cycle of, they took the land, the conquest essentially ran from 1405 B.C. It took them about 6 years to 1399. And then the period of the Judges follows from there up until the time of Saul. And Saul becomes king. I believe he was. Solomon was from 970 to 930. So add 40 for David. So he was 1050 to 1010. And then Saul was before that. So you have to fit the period of the Judges back into this, say, 200 or so year period of history, or almost three. But it can be done. And there are answers to all those chronological questions as well. But during this time, after they took the land, they were at kind of a spiritual high point. This was when Israel was at its best. Then they would go through a period of spiritual decline. And God would begin to judge them. And they'd bottom out, and then they'd begin to make a comeback. They never did achieve the greatness at any time during the period of the judges that they had at the conquest. And this pattern went on all the time under the period of the judges. And Israel was eventually going down, and they made a big comeback under, say, at some level under Saul, but specifically more under David and Solomon was the high point of the kingdom. So Judges 2:18 here, when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed and afflicted them. But it came about when the judge died, they would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers. So what'd you learn in all this? Nothing, essentially. As a nation, what'd they learn? Nothing. And that's why they were on this sort of downward spiral kind of thing almost. So downward cycle anyway. And then Judges 4:3. The sons of Israel, now here they were oppressed by Jabin, the king of Canaan, in verse 2. And the commander of his army was Sisera. And the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. And in this case, he raises up a female judge, Deborah, who is a prophetess. She helped deliver the nation during that time. Well, 50, while Koheleth bemoans the fact that observing injustice and oppression make life miserable, it should be evident that his complaints are an indictment of life in Israel at the time of writing. Or certainly that he has observed this during his lifetime, maybe not so much at the time of writing, but maybe at the time of writing, that he's observed this pretty regularly, apparently. 51, it would seem from what is not said that he is also troubled by the fact that God allows this to happen and does not seem to intervene or seem to correct this injustice. And the fact is, when you see an injustice or you see something wrong, and oftentimes we want it corrected and we want it corrected then. And God just doesn't do that. It's been my experience that people can pull some incredible stunts. And God appears to let them go, we might say. Now, what will happen at the Bema Seat and all the impacts of their stunts in their life and all of that? Well, we can't see all that. And that awaits the future. But at some level, you have to recognize, you know, if everybody that's ever gone negative, if God just killed them the second they stepped out the door, well, one, there'd be a big pile of bodies out there. It'd be hard to get to class. But it doesn't work that way. And God is patient and allows people time, you know, to recover if they at all can. And he doesn't just immediately step in with judgment. He may give them more than enough rope so they will hang themselves. That may trouble you. That you, okay, I want to see this injustice corrected. Well, you may or may not see it corrected. And that's where you, again, to me, this all says you got to faith rest this. Either God's in control, which he's just alluded to in this book, or he's not. Either he's got these times in hand, or he doesn't. And sure, there's a period where it looks like oppression is going to win, injustice is going to win, and all of that. But God doesn't necessarily step in and intervene right away, maybe like we'd like him to. So you just have to step back and say, okay, well, it's God's call. God knows what's going on. It's not as though he doesn't know. He's got to know. Omniscience applied. So 52, as we pointed out in the introduction of this book is designed to encourage and strengthen faith in that which is of real value by exposing the insubstantial things that Solomon has observed and even pursued in his own lifetime. 53, further, his personal observations about the nature of things should serve as a source of encouragement when younger people encounter these types of inequities and oppressions later in their lives. They're going to live to see this, and he knows it, and that's why I think that's part of the reason why he focuses on this is to say, you're going to see this and this and this and this and this, and it's not always going to be pleasant when you see it. In fact, it may be oppressive. That's how I read this, that he finds all this oppressive. That he wants life to be something better than what it is. And yet, it's not. In the devil's world, this isn't the way it works. 53, to that end, Koheleth does not attempt to water down or ignore the more difficult issues of life. He wants his readers to recognize that this is the way it is under the sun. You can bemoan the fact. You can wish it different. You know, whatever you want to do. But the fact is, you can't change it. And so you have to recognize at a certain level, okay, there is oppression, there is affliction, there is injustice out there. One, I don't want to be the source of that. I don't want to be one of those people that God has promised to jam for oppressing, you know, trying to take financial advantage of the weaker segment of society or segments of society and all that. So that's one of the things the younger reader could do. Say, okay, all right, I don't want to be that kind of person. That would be one benefit that would come out of this. That you read this and you say, okay, yeah, that's wrong. Yeah, I don't want to do that. Okay, well now he moves to human competition and a couple of related proverbs. And one of the things you have out there, and you've always had it, I mean, we've all heard the phrase, keeping up with the Joneses. Who are the Joneses? And why do we have to keep up with them? Who said? Well, that's the mentality, though, of the human race. And that mentality pre-existed America. But it has certainly flourished in latter modern-day America. That you gotta get on, it's all onward and upward. I was, one of the things, even as a funding, and I see it now, even, quote, in the doctrinal movement, there's no such thing as far as I'm concerned, just about, but in the, quote, doctrinal movement, it's always onward and upward. When you're a funding, you never candidated for a church that was smaller than the one you had. It was always bigger than the one you had. And there was this sort of hierarchy, and people understood this, that you were always trying to make these steps up. Same thing's true out here in modern America. You don't sell your house and buy something smaller, unless you weren't retiring. I mean, if you're a young person, you're out here trying to get ahead, get more equity so I can get a bigger house, so I can buy more stuff. I need to tear this house down and build barns so I can put my stuff in them. And so it's always onward and upward. And what does this come out of? Human competition. The desire to one-up people. The desire to be better than them. Or to show that you're better. Or to make them think you're better than them. And well, what's all that about? That's just arrogance and stupidity. And again, human competition. And we would have to distinguish, or at least I would, between a legitimate competitive drive in life that causes a person to try to do well and all that, and this sort of STA competition. Now, you don't want to get involved in STA competitions. Even if you win, you don't win. So you got the bigger, better house, the bigger, better car, the bigger, better wife. So what? Are you happy? No, I'm not happy. And again, when working at the pharmacy all those years, I mean, I'd see people and the richest, most... people that had the most were often the very most miserable. They just, they'd drive 45 minutes from Longboat Key to save 50 cents on a prescription. I'd stand there and shake my head. Well, they used to say penny wise and pound foolish. So, now if you have to drive 15 minutes to get a deal, well, you've wasted $3 in gas. So you better add that to the cost of your prescription. But I'd watch people do this, and I just thought to myself, and of course, there were some people, seriously, it was almost like a contest with them. Who could get the best deal? And then there are people like that, too. Oh, I got the best deal. Look, if God blesses you with something, it's a good deal if God blessed you with it. Whether it costs a little more or a little less, at some level, is irrelevant. And I have seen that every labor... and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. But this too is vanity and striving after the wind. And I have seen again, and I saw, wow, here plus the cow perfect of Ra'ah. Again, personal observation, you can't argue with him. He says he's seen it. He says he's observed it. And I have observed, I myself, again, the pronoun, the independent pronoun, first person, ani. I observed all work. Again, he's hyperbole Solomon. How could you have seen everything? But he claims essentially to say, I've seen everything. He says, I've watched everything. I've seen all the people being oppressed. How could you see them all? You couldn't. But he's using this hyperbole to make his point, to say that this does exist out there. And of course, anybody that observes the human experience would say, well, yeah, he's right. Whether he uses hyperbole to make his point or not, it's irrelevant. He's right. I have seen that you got the sign of the direct object here, which just looks like F, and then coal, all, each, or every. Here you had translated every work because you got a singular, masculine, singular noun, of amal. A-M-A-L. Again, work or labor, this is the type of work that focuses on the hard work, the rigorous labor and the toil aspect of it, we might say. That every toil, and is a wow, plus another sign of the direct object, and then coal again, and every, and then you got this word here, kishron. K-I-S-H-R-O-N. Kishron is used only three times. Normally it means success. That which comes from the exertion of effort and skillful work. It has a force here of an objective genitive. The idea here is this is what's produced. When a guy is good at his job, he meets with success. That every success is a better translation here than every skill. Although the only way you're going to be successful, I understand there's an overlap here between, you know, your skill at what you do and the success with which you meet. But I think the end result here, the emphasis is on the end result, the success. And then this is the success, and again, this is more an objective, the success that's produced from labor. This is what labor produces. If you work hard and you're skillful at it, you meet with success. So here you have the every skill, they said, or every success which is done. You got the definite article plus the masculine singular noun. Every success of the work, we might say, or which comes from work, and that word is ma'aseh. M-A-A-S-E-H. Again, every work, every skill involved in the work, every accomplishment. You can even translate that word before every skill, every accomplishment. Because that every success or accomplishment, that's what comes from hard, diligent work, if you're good at it. So again, every success that comes from the work, all the skillful work, all the successful achievement, we might say. What prompts men to go out there and achieve in life? And isn't it very often simply the desire to outdo the next guy? That there's a real rivalry that extends out there in the world. And that's what Solomon's pointing to here. That every work or every success, every achievement which is accomplished is the result, and they've supplied here as you can tell, is the result of rivalry. You have here a conjunction key that he... And she, actually here you have the pronoun here, third feminine singular, he. And that points to the feminine singular noun construct that follows. Jealousy is the idea that it comes as a result, that it, jealousy, we might say. The verb here, or the noun, the feminine singular noun construct, is kinah. Q-I-N-A-H. Q-I-N-A, apostrophe A-H. The verb denotes the expression of a strong emotional response to a person wanting some quality or possession of another person. It is used of zeal, that you want it, you lust after it, is the idea. Envy, rivalry, competition, animosity, you can even say, you know, some people, they want what other people have simply because they want to have it. And they resent the fact that another person has something. If you find yourself resenting what other people have, you're out of fellowship. Clear and simple, you're out of fellowship. I don't care how much they have, why are you lusting after it? Why do you want it? And the answer isn't, it isn't good. And so here when you get into this envy or jealousy aspect of it, and again, it can even shade into anger, because some people get angry because other people have stuff. People make some outlandish comment, why should they have anything? Why shouldn't they? Who made you the judge of this? Why shouldn't they have something? And if you resent what people have, you're making a huge mistake in life. Number one, you're questioning the wisdom and judgment of God. You know, assuming that what if God gave this person all that stuff? So now you find yourself at odds with God because you don't like the fact God did it. But now you won't come out and say, I hate God. Because he gave all this person this stuff, you'll take it out on the person. And that's the way it works. People don't generally take out on God what they're upset with God about. They try to take it out on somebody else. So again, this is the idea here is rivalry or competition, which stems from some envy or jealousy. Again, this comes from it. The envy or jealousy produces the competition. This mental attitude behind it all. So I've never begrudged anybody anything. If you've got something, good for you. I'm glad. As a matter of fact, that's my prayer every week, week in and week out, always the same prayer. You prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. And so I hope you are successful financially, physically, emotionally. I hope you're healthy. This is the normal attitude that the pastor has towards his congregation. As expressed by John, obviously. I made this up. John expresses this in his one of his epistles. That in every regard, in every area, you'll prosper and be in good health even as your soul prospers. But the first thing I pray for is your soul prosperity. If you're not prospering there, what difference does it make you have everything? The goal is soul prosperity. This is why you have a pastor. He's here to teach you and provide all the doctrine so that you can enjoy soul prosperity, and not only in time, but ultimately so you can enjoy prosperity at the Bema seat and beyond, so that you can have everything that is possible for God to provide for you. Now that's what this is all about. And if a guy's not in the ministry for that reason, he shouldn't be in the ministry, in my opinion. If he's not there to do that, that's why you're here. And so there's no room for this envy or jealousy or look around, oh, I wish I had a bigger church. Look at that pastor. He's got a bigger church. Nah. One of the things I learned this early on. I remember it stuck in my head. One of the first tapes I ever listened to was more people mean more problems. And so the people out there praying, we want the church to grow. I remember when I was candidating once, I didn't actually get down there, but they contacted me. It was in Mississippi, of all places. Can't remember the name. It was right there on the Gulf. I believe it was Pass Christian. And that's what they said when I gave them my deal. They said, Pass Christian. We're not interested. Because one of their questions to me was, well, how are you going to help the church to grow? I said, well, by teaching doctrine. Well, no, we mean in numbers. Well, then I'm not your guy, I don't think. And so, you know, that didn't last very long. Because there the motive was bigger, better church. Translates into more happiness. More money, I guess. I don't know. What all are they looking for? And so I figured out early on, you know, there's no place for this envy or rivalry. Certainly not among pastors, not even among the congregation. When people look around and they're upset with other believers because they've got something, well, that's a mental attitude sin. That's envy, jealousy, whatever it is. Envy tends to focus on what the other person has and wanting it for yourself, whereas jealousy tends to focus on what you already have that you don't want to share. And so, you get jealous. If somebody gets some attention that you didn't think they should get or whatever. That's where jealousy is. Envy is, I wish you didn't have it, or by the way, I want it. And that's in the worst case scenario, where you not only say, I want it, I resent the fact that you got it in the first place. And that's so inappropriate. And Solomon says, life is permeated with this. I've seen that when people are successful, why are they doing it in many cases? And they're doing it to one-up the neighbor. To prove that, hey, I'm better than you. I know you're not. You can do what you want. I just choose not to complicate my niche. Could I sell all I got and get bigger, better stuff? Sure. But why complicate your niche? So here again, rivalry, competition, envy, jealousy, all these mental attitude sins provoke a lot of human effort. And so it comes in some cases from a very bad source. And then you have here, we might say, well, they've translated here, it's jealousy of a man. And so they've translated it between, which is fine. It expresses what's going on here. Jealousy and a man from his neighbor. Here, preposition men used in a causal sense. He's jealous because of his neighbor. It's irritating. And the word neighbor actually is a masculine singular noun construct plus a third masculine suffix of re'ah, R-E'A. And this word means a friend, an acquaintance, an associate, or a companion. So they translated it neighbor, but the idea is it could just be somebody on your job. It doesn't have to be your quote next door neighbor. Although there, you know, we certainly know that goes on in life. You know, you gotta outdo the neighbor. We're coming up. My favorite time of year, Christmas time. Who's gonna have the biggest display? Got to outdo the neighbors. Got to get them lights up. And pass. Not interested in trying to show off the neighbors or show them up. And think of how much effort is wasted in this stuff of just trying to one up the next guy. That you're just wasting effort in this, because number one, you're doing it probably out of fellowship, and God's not blessing it. So it could be frustrated. How many things can go wrong if you're on a ladder from hanging from your roof? What could possibly go wrong there? Well, you could end up flat on your back on the ground. Dare I say it, Peace River. What could go wrong now? Well, a man and his neighbor. Again, this can be anybody, an acquaintance, somebody you know, somebody you meet, you want to show them up. This too is vanity and striving after wind. You got the adverb here, gam, which leads it off. Also, indeed, or even. And they translated it to. This, masculine singular adjective of zeh, and then his favorite word, of course, throughout this book, hevel. H-E-V-H-E-L. This is empty. This is fruitless. This is absurd. This is pointless. And chasing after or striving after is re'uth, and then ruach, the wind. And I don't think he could have found a better phrase that really communicates the futility of things than chasing the wind. Chasing that which is insubstantial, that you never can catch. And it's just, it's a part of insanity. The fool holds his hands and consumes his flesh. Now we've moved into, he's made this statement, and now he's going to make a couple of related proverbs to put this into some perspective and some balance. So, because what would be the first response to this? First logical response was, well, if all this skill and all this work and done is just be done because of rivalry, then what's the point of doing anything? And the answer is, well, that would be one a guess, and he's going to counter that with the fool. The fool does nothing. So he's not advocating here the do nothing approach in life. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. The fool is a definite article plus kesil. K-E-S-I-Y-L. And we'll have a doctrine of fools and folly at the end of this chapter, because there's going to be a couple of fools mentioned in this chapter. The fool, calactic participle here, of kabak, C-H-A-B-H-A-Q. The participle here again emphasizes ongoing action. The word itself means to embrace or to hug, to put the hands around something. To fold the hands here is a figure for idleness or sloth. The fool folds his hands. Well, I can't do anything then. I'll just sit here. So I don't want to be guilty of this stupid rivalry, so I won't do anything. Well, he says that makes you a fool. And by the way, the word fool is not, some of suggest here, well, maybe he's using fool in a good way. No. No, the fool's never considered a good thing. Do you, when somebody walks up to you and says, you damn fool, does that make you feel good? They're not complimenting you. And this is not a compliment here. But some interpreters look at it and say, well, maybe he's trying to make an opposite point. No, it means what it says. The fool folds his hands. And then folds is actually our hugs or holds them. And then you got the sign of the direct object plus the word yad, hands. The fool folds his hands, yad actually, and consumes his own flesh. And as well, calactic participle, both of these are ongoing here. And is eating, akhal, A-K-H-A-L. And is eating. Sign of the direct object here, plus the masculine singular noun construct, basar, his own flesh. His own body. The word Solomon used basar here, and there's some alternate interpretative looks at this, but I've checked out basar, and he only uses it for the physical body in this book. He doesn't use it any other way. So the physical body is what he's talking about. We know what flesh is. The flesh, your body. One hand, verse 6 now, and now he offers an alternate viewpoint. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. And this is another one of his good, better than expressions. Good from means better than. Better than one hand here, and actually what you have is the word, you got the noun, or the masculine singular noun here of melo. M-E-L-O apostrophe. Literally fullness is what that word means. That which, what fills something up. You can even translate almost as a passive. Being filled, the palm, literally, is calf. K-A-P-H. And that just means this, you know, it's like your palm. You hold your palm up, and if, you know, it's full, you got something in it. One hand full of rest is nachath, N-A-C-H-A-T-H. This word means rest or quietness. It emphasizes lack of motion, ease, and even security at some level. That you're not just, as it, but you're safe in all this too. You're not really just absent motion, but there's some security involved. So good from, and then you finally get the men down here, the preposition men. One palm full of rest is better than, and then you have the same one again, melo, and then he changes here to a masculine dual noun of kophen. C-H-O-P-H-E-N. Kophen is used 6 times, and it's used of the hands now. The difference is when they are cupped or filled. So you might say, you know, you got the one palm full of whatever it is, whatever's in the palm. And then you got your hands held like this, cupped hands. And so you're really trying to get more in there, right? And so he's saying one hand full of rest is better than two fists full. It's not fists, though. It's actually, again, cupped hands. And then, of course, the idea is once you cup them and you get what you want, then you close your hands over it. That's why they translate it fist, because you get your hands full and then you close them so you can hang on to it. What are you hanging on to? Striving after labor and striving after wind. So two hands full, we might say, of labor. Amal is this one again. Again, the labor, the toil, the hard work. Two hands full of hard work. And, wow, striving is Reuth again, striving after the wind. And our time is gone, so we will stop there and be ready to dive into this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word this morning. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.